Avrokitos was on his way to his fourth interview with IBM when his favorite professor, Dr. Richard Cottam, suggested that he might like to speak to a man connected with American intelligence. Cottam, an expert on the Middle East, whom Jimmy Carter would later tap for secret missions to Iran, was one of those men the CIA looked to in the country's universities to spot potential. Avrokitos still remembers the university room where he was told to report for the interview. 7E21. There was nothing physically interesting about the CIA man, but he knew how to talk Avrokitos's language. He registered pleasure that Gust had graduated summa cum laude. He said it was useful that Gust spoke Greek and that he was so good with figures. But it was clear right away what really interested him, Gust recalls. He recognized my real talent, that I was a fucking street guy. How do you feel about playing in dark alleys? He asked. I love it, replied Avrokitos. You're just what I'm looking for. When Avrokitos told him how much IBM was offering, the visitor said he was embarrassed and could offer only a third of that, $5,355 a year. But I can give you one thing IBM can't, he said. I can have you trained and overseas doing something for your country in 1.5 years. Avrokitos was hooked by the idea of becoming a spy for America. Instead, for the next 3 months, the CIA spied on him. The Office of Security sent its sleuths to Aliquippa to ferret out any communist influences in his family. They flew him to Washington, his first trip on an airplane, for a series of lie detector tests to see if he was homosexual or if he had anything to hide. Finally, the CIA told him they were going to induct him into their elite case officer training program, not the Office of Security, not logistics or science and technology. They were going to take Oscar Avrokitos's son into their ultimate inner sanctum, into the Directorate of Operations, Archie Roosevelt's club. When Avrokitos tried to read up on the CIA, he discovered there were no books or magazine articles explaining what the agency did or what kind of people worked there. No one wrote about the CIA then. It was considered unpatriotic. The agency was just moving into its $250 million headquarters hidden in the woods of Langley, Virginia, 8 miles up the Potomac from the White House. Its design gave it the look of a modern campus, or perhaps a corporate headquarters, and some 15,000 employees worked there, but no sign acknowledged its existence from the road except a false one that read Bureau of Public Works. Any citizens who went looking for this non-existent bureaucracy would find themselves facing a police barricade and a polite order to turn around. It was into this mysterious world that Avrokitos descended on August 1, 1962. The majority of the 50 recruits in his class were from the Ivy Leagues, predominantly Harvard, Yale, and Brown. The others came from places like the universities of Pittsburgh, Nebraska, or Kansas, or technological schools such as Carnegie Tech and Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. The way Avrokitos computed it, there were 38 Ivy Leaguers and 12 of us. But he quickly developed a begrudging respect for all his classmates. He was impressed to find that the agency had compiled a list of the country's valedictorians and had managed to enlist many of them. When you grow up realizing the only way to get out of the shithole is by using your brain, you respect brains. And all these people were using their fucking brains, all of them. Half had master's degrees. Many spoke several languages. Avrokitos remembers one Harvard man who could recite Chaucer as if he were carrying on a simple conversation. For the next year and a half, these 50 chosen ones stayed together, learning the tradecraft of the spy. At Camp Peary, Virginia, the agency's boot camp near Jamestown, Virginia, where the first Americans made their settlement, the new spies learned how to use firearms and detonate explosives. They went through a demanding survival course and parachuted out of planes. They traveled to different cities to practice shadowing and shaking surveillance. They learned how to sketch and diagram, how to make surreptitious entries, how to work with bugging experts and polygraph operators, how to pass messages secretly, how to infiltrate agents, how to compromise or recruit their adversaries. There was a sense in those days of readying for war. The two superpowers were spending the bulk of their national budgets preparing to deliver an all-out nuclear attack within a matter of minutes. Over 15,000 nuclear warheads were aimed at each other's cities and military targets. On the border of Western Europe stood 90 Soviet divisions. The United States and its NATO allies conducted constant exercises in anticipation of an all-out conventional war. But no one doubted that it would inevitably go nuclear if so much as a division crossed the frontier. The superpowers had turned themselves into helpless giants, neither side willing to use its true might. With no other real outlet, the entire globe became the battleground of the spies. There was hardly a country where the KGB and CIA were not facing off in one way or another. Avrakatos and his classmates assumed they'd be going into battle the moment they got their first assignment overseas. It was a time when places no one thought much about kept leaping onto the front pages as critical battlegrounds of the Cold War. The CIA's Cubans fighting the Soviets' Cubans, the American-backed Vietnamese against the communist Vietnamese. CIA agents came to view themselves as global cancer surgeons trying to identify and remove, or at least contain, even the most minor malignancies, lest they grow into full-scale threats that might later precipitate a nuclear confrontation. It was dirty business, but deemed as necessary as the cut of a scalpel in the hand of a surgeon. A Castro in Cuba could spread his revolution not just to Central America, but throughout Latin America. As the colonial powers began pulling out, all of Africa was up for grabs. A black Castro could infect the entire continent. There was no middle ground in this struggle. And everywhere, the invisible generals in the only true battles allowed to be fought were the spies. This was the world Gustav Rakatos moved into in 1963, when, after completing his training, he was given his first overseas post. It would be hard to underestimate the sense of destiny he felt when he learned he would be posted to the country of his parents' birth. Now he was going back, not just to defend Greece's freedom, but, as President Kennedy put it, to be a watchman on the walls of freedom. Greece was not just the cradle of democracy, it was where the Cold War had begun. The Truman Doctrine had been created to counter the threat of armed communist infiltration in Greece and Turkey. The Marshall Plan had poured in hundreds of millions to rescue the economy, and the CIA was determined to keep the Greeks, who were NATO allies, from voting for leftists. By the time Avrakatos arrived, the agency was intervening in every aspect of Greek life. It had created and funded the Greek Central Intelligence Service, whose operatives worked with it hand in glove. CIA men busied themselves planting stories, funding candidates, monitoring the communists, neutralizing their champions, showering their own clients with gifts and services. It was a massive undertaking, but Avrakatos was surprised to discover that 142 agents were already in place. The station chief didn't even bother to introduce himself for 2 months. This was a strange, insular world for a new CIA operative to get used to. There was a virtual taboo against befriending Americans in Greece, and most of the real diplomats of the embassy treated their spy colleagues as if they were untouchables. "They called us spooks," Avrakatos recalls. "It's different in a small embassy like in Dakar, Calcutta, where there may be only 5 people posted and you're the only Americans in town. But in the big embassies in Paris, Rome, Tokyo, London, spooks are separate. It's a real caste system. You can tell the way they spit it out when they ask your opinion. Well, what do the spooks think?" The spooks themselves considered case officers green for their first 2 tours. Some of the veterans insist that you really can't be a true pro until you have 20 years of espionage behind you. But Avrakatos was an irrepressible self-starter. He spoke Greek like a native and knew how to build on opportunities. On April 21, 1967, he got one of those breaks that can make a career, when a military junta seized power in Athens and suspended democratic and constitutional government. Liberals in the United States and around the world were outraged, but overnight, the colonel's coup turned Avrakatos into one of the CIA's indispensable frontline players. Well before this, he had made it his business to get to know the colonels. They had all started off life as peasants before joining the army, and they felt a kinship with this charismatic working-class American whose parents had come from Lemnos. They could speak Greek with him, he drank and whored with them, and they knew from the heart that he shared their ferocious anti-communism. Avrakatos understood that the colonels had expected the United States to thank them, however discreetly, for preventing an anti-American candidate, Andreas Papandreou, from taking power. The polls had indicated that Papandreou would win the election, and the colonels suspected that the CIA itself was trying to sabotage Papandreou's campaign. But world reaction was so bitter and the move so brutally anti-democratic that the Johnson administration took to verbally attacking the junta and threatening to cut off U.S. assistance. After the colonels arrested Papandreou, who had lived in the United States for years, the embassy sent Avrakatos to deliver a message to them. The United States had taken the unusual step of issuing the Greek leader an American passport, and the embassy wanted the junta to permit him to leave the country. "That's the official position. You should let him go," the young CIA man told the colonels. "But unofficially, as your friend, my advice is to shoot the motherfucker because he's going to come back to haunt you." This was vintage Aliquippa wisdom, and just the kind of statement made at just the right moment to cement a true conspirator's friendship. One can only imagine the trouble Avrakatos might have gotten into if the ambassador had learned about his private remarks, but he didn't, and now, at 29, Avrakatos had suddenly leapt to the front of the pack and transformed himself into the CIA's all-important agent at the very heart of the new power center of Greece.